Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. My name is Daryl Urbanski, your host as always. And today we are joined by Simon Burney, Vice President and Head of APAC, Middle East and Africa, Customer Success at Purview, a leader with over 30 years of global experience in professional services and customer success. Simon has excelled in developing high-performance teams and driving significant business growth across diverse industries. His expertise spans strategic planning, project plus financial management, and proactive business development. Simon is a champion of diversity, equity, and inclusion, advocating for gender advancement and supporting those with disabilities. With an executive MBA from SP Jane School of Global Management and various certifications, Simon is a dynamic leader dedicated to customer delight and innovation. I've asked him to join us here today to share his story and insights from his extensive experience in global leadership and technology. So Simon, thank you so much for joining us today. How you doing?
Thank you, Daryl. Really appreciate the time.
Yeah, good to have you here. So before we hop into sort of the nuts and bolts of how to excel in your field, how did you even get started in business development and this kind of success, this avenue? Is this a family endeavor? Are your parents involved in the same industry? Are they entrepreneurs, or were they involved in business development in some capacity themselves?
It's more my father left school without a qualification, joined the army, and worked really hard. Right. When he left the army, he went into the corporate world, taking the ethos of delivering customer success, always excelling at giving more than what the customer wants in the point that what the customer needs. My mother, very similar. She actually finished school, and then she decided to stay at home and raise us boys, my two older brothers, and then start working after that. And she also drove that customer success through her experiences in the different industries, going from being a base commander's secretary through to finishing as a global leader of ADP payroll services, doing global transformation for companies like Intel and Microsoft. And so taking what they've ingrained into me, I've always been one that wants to ensure that I deliver what the customer needs, and then go beyond that to make sure that they get customer delight and come back for more in that space. So learning all the way through, and Dad would drag me along to his work and say, "Hey, son, go sweep that floor, you know, go count that stock," and really get me involved. And then he'd give me $5, say, "Thank you. Good work, son."
I love that.
And then mum would be come to work and send me to the dungeon where all the books were and get me to audit the papers and put them into chronological order. So it was that early discipline of teaching me about the value of money and the value of what good looks like. When we think about what does good look like, it's more than what we think it is. It's understanding what the customer wants, what the stakeholder wants from that. So going through school, interestingly enough, I was originally going to be a deep sea diver because I figured, hey, why not? It's work 6 months of the year and then holiday and party for 6 months of the year. But then I found I couldn't get into that industry segment. It was around fitness and personal health. So becoming a fitness trainer, owning a gym, you know, that there at the time, way back then, money wasn't very good for fitness trainers. So I moved into IT, and IT I've found is IT is the avenue of which gives me the opportunity to do more, both in the community and society, helping others develop and helping businesses be successful in understanding new markets, being brave, failing fast, and taking that chance, that calculated risk to be successful.
Said something, I'm a writer downer. There's a few things that you said, but you said something that interests me right near at the end, that interests me more than the rest. Understanding new markets. What does that mean? It sounds great, but what does that mean? And how do you do it?
Yeah, so understanding new markets, the biggest thing is if you read up on something, it's somebody's perspective. It's somebody else's idea of what the market looks like. Going to the market, going there on a holiday, going there and meeting business connections, understanding the commerce, really getting to know the market helps so much. When I think about my career journey, the most impactful was moving. I started with Dell Technologies as the longest tenure I had, with the responsibility of New Zealand and the South Pacific. Now, there's a lot of atolls. There's a lot of islands that are in the South Pacific. And I know a lot of Polynesian people, been to Rarotonga once, and so it was good. But then when I actually had a project to deliver computers across the South Pacific, I initially thought, it's just like New Zealand. Chuck it on the plane, it'll get delivered, it'll turn up, and things worked fine. I got two little nuggets from that one. I had my team call me from an island called Karabati, and which is a little atoll that has a runway, and that's about it. And there's Polynesian people there, and they said that when they got on the plane in Fiji, their computers, they watched out the window as the forklift took their computers off the plane and put water on the plane. And they still flew to Karabati. The plane goes once a week. So this project that was going to be in and out in 7 days was 14 days long, because that's just how things work. And so I started to learn, okay, so that's, I need to go to Samoa. I'm going to make sure this stuff turns up. Thankfully, I did. I flew into Samoa 2 days before the plane was supposed to arrive, went down to the airport on the day the plane was supposed to arrive. And the freight company said, oh, yeah, no, the airline changed the from a wide body plane to a narrow body plane. And there was a concert here in Samoa, so your stop didn't turn up. And I was like, okay, that's, I've never heard of that before. Yeah. And so being there, I then talked to the local customer and understood what drives them. And at the end of the day, they want to give back to the community. They want to, it was part of a church organization, giving back to the community. They took me around the island, showed me how things were. I got a greater appreciation for the Pacific Islands through those experiences. And then fortunately, I was allowed to then transfer up to Singapore and look after Asia. And so that's going from a grouping of atolls and islands to an amazing, more than 27 countries of responsibility to deliver services into. And so taking that initial learning and just going in eyes open, curious, respectful, and understanding what makes business tick, because no market, all markets are similar, but each market is unique.
I think it's a really powerful lesson. I just talked to a new member to one of my programs, and he came, he's like, Darryl, can you look at this for me? And I said, sure. And it was his marketing plan. And he was like, I'm going to run some ads to download this thing. And then I'm going to, and none of it talked about who.
Mm.
And so I was like, but who? Who is going to see this? And what pain are you solving for them? And I feel like that's just such an important thing. And it's just one of the tips that we ended up, when I finished with the feedback, was we ended up going, hey, he's helped. He already has a list of case studies. He's going to pick his favorite customer. Basically, he's got three of them that fit the same stereotype. Mm-hmm. Just go get 100 more of them. Because how much more powerful will everything be if you can speak to their specific situation, their specific reasons, their pain, versus, yeah, it's like shoes. You don't buy a shoe, you buy a walking shoe, a running shoe, a hiking shoe. I think there's real, real power in what you said. So now when you talked about some of there, are you, whatever happened, I felt like there was an open loop left there. So your freight kept disappearing on these deliveries. Is this corruption? Is this, what is this? You end up having to put someone on the plane to personally escort the stuff through? What's going on here?
Wow. So interesting spin on that. So it's to learn to understand that in different countries, there's priority given to different types of product. So when we think about Karabati, they don't have natural water. There's no spring on the island. So regardless of who buys stock freight positions on the plane, if the country doesn't have enough water to supply, the water will go on the plane ahead of everybody else. And so that market has Maslow's law. It's you've got to give them water for them to get anything else. Who cares about computers if there's no water?
And then all the water inside of it type thing.
Yeah. And it's really one of those interesting things where, you know, when we live in a single country and only experience a single country's economy and sociology, we become a little snow dome. A little snow dome, you shake it and everything settles to perfect again. After my Samoa trip, which was great, it was amazing. I got to meet some amazing people and really blessed for that experience. I then went to Tonga. Now, this is where you think about the potential word corruption, but it's actually just the way the country runs. And it's not corruption. It's understanding it. So I flew into Tonga on the week that they were doing the first ever election after being a monarchy. And so I flew in with the client with me. And the client, he's able to go in, not a problem, because he's got a company there. They let him straight through. I, for the first time in my life, was reading on the plane a book. And I was standing in the immigration queue reading a book. And he was waving at me going, like, trying to get my attention. And what he wanted me to do was to change my immigration form from saying business to saying tourist.
Yeah.
Even though as a New Zealander, I can go there for business. And I'm like,
yeah.
So I get up counter, and the immigration guy goes, "Oh, you're here for business. What business are you here for?" And I'm like, "Okay, professional services, you're helping the church to refresh all your assets." Yeah, and they go, "Well, come with me, sir." And so I went with them into a room, and they sat me down and questioned me some more, and then said, "We're taking your passport from you, and we'll give it back to you after we work out what you're doing here in this country." And so I was in Tonga, first time ever, customers in Tonga with me. He's outside the airport. I'm in the locked up room. They then release me under house arrest. So I go to the church campus. I'm allowed to stay on the campus in the dorm. I'm not allowed to leave. And so I'm like, this is new. I've never experienced this.
Yeah.
Thankfully, English speaking country. But I was ringing my boss in Australia, my account manager in New Zealand. They were ringing the Australian consulate, the New Zealand embassy, trying to get my passport released. And it was all because the person behind the desk didn't want the democracy to come. He wanted to stay with the monarchy. So he saw any business traveler as a negative thing for their community.
Yeah.
I flew in on Friday. And so on Monday, I tried to get what I needed. And they said, "Oh, sorry, there's a death on the island. Tonga is an island, it's a country. So everything's shut. Nothing's open on Monday." Okay, so it's 3 days in. I'd managed to contact my engineers, so they changed it to visitor when they arrived into the airport. By Wednesday, I was given my passport back, 5 days without a passport. I go down to the freight company and say, "Can I get the computers?" And they go, "Yeah, we're just waiting for the IT guy." And I'm like, okay, so this is me being proactive, driving for results. Just don't wait for an answer, go and get an answer. And I'm like, "What do you need the IT guy for?" He goes, "To turn the computers on." And I'm like, "What?" And he's, "Yes." I'm like, "Can't you turn it?" "No, we're not allowed to turn them on." So every day in this freight company, they waited for the IT guy to come in and press the power button on the base, power cut button on the monitor, logged them in for them, and then they worked. And it was really an amazing experience, because then it means the feeling I had when I went to a foreign country and got pulled aside and got told, "You shouldn't be here, you're not allowed to be here," makes me appreciate when I send people to other countries.
Yeah.
To new countries, you know, say, when you go there, I want to make sure you're correctly visa to get in there. I want to make sure you've got somebody there that's going to support you, really help them to get through the door. And because it's a horrible feeling, no passport, nowhere to travel,
I'm going to have to tell my own little immigration story here, because the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So whatever good intentions there are behind some of these immigration policies, they don't always work the way, like, perfect example right now, the U.S. has millions of illegals pouring across the border. So I worked in San Diego for 2 years, and I'm a Canadian, and Canadians can just go work in America for no reason. We have basically, I don't even know how long it is, 6 months, a year, something as a tourist, unlimited, just back and forth, just show your ID away you go. I went there to work, and I got a 1-year TN visa by showing I had a contract with a client. I have a contract with a client down there. Oh, okay, there you go, TN visa, there you go. Oh, I got to renew it a year later. Okay, here's the renewal of the contract. Okay, go. I had a new client. I go home for Christmas. I go back thinking everything's going to be the same. I didn't want to play games. I wanted to be like straight and narrow. My visa was set to renew, whatever, just January 1st or 2nd or something. I got a flight the 3rd or 4th, the day after. So it didn't look like I was trying to squeak in. So I was, just going to show we're good. And I get up and they pull me out of line. And I get taken to this other room, and the guy's looking at the contract with this client, and he's looking at this thing. And I'm just going to say it. My fee for the project was 50,000 US plus commission. And it was a real estate guy. And he had asked me, "What are you going to do with the 50? And I said, "I don't know, put in real estate or something." He goes, "I'll tell you what, why don't I just get you a house worth at least 50,000 US. It's cash flowing at least $1,000 positive cash flow a month, has a property management company in place. And we just do that instead of paying you 50 grand in cash." Okay, sure. So I can pull that line, and the guy, the second tier, he's reading this. He's like, "A house?" I go, "Yeah, it's a house." I go, "Yeah, why?" "They're buying you a house." And this was the contract between me and our client, like our lawyers. Going, Now, again, like you said, I could have just said I was a tourist. I could have just said I'm a tourist and just gone right through and dealt with it. And I'd already been living there 2 years. I have an apartment. I have a car. I had a hot date with an LA model that I've been trying to, we were going to a wedding she invited me to. We've been trying to connect for a couple of months. A mentor friend of mine was gifting me to take over. He was like his black book. He had a coaching group that was meeting once a month. And my best friend, actually, my daughter's middle name is his first name. He was doing a launch and I promised him I would be there to help. So I had all these reasons to get back. Anyways, so he's like, a house. And I'm like, yeah, a house. And he picks up the phone and he calls someone and he asks about his Christmas overtime hour check when he's getting it. And he asks him, he's going to hear about his pay raise that he did. He requested. And he hangs the phone. You're not going to the States today until you come back with 5 years financials. And this letter needs to be addressed, dear immigration officer. And this bullet point list, this needs to be separated into what you're doing and what they're doing. And he's like, you're not, and sends me home. And I'm shocked. I'm like, what? Now I have access to all this. I have access to all the company's financials. This is January 3rd or something. The office isn't open until the 10th. So I go home and I do it. I take the contract. I separate the bullets. I add all the parties' cell phone, direct phone number. That's his phone number. That's his phone number. Call him, check him. We're good. And the other thing, I had to be on the letterhead. And so I printed it with the company's logo on the paper. I go back like two days later. I get the same guy.
Oh, wow. What's the chance?
And I'm just this friendly Canadian. Yeah, what's going on? He's like, man, how'd you? And I have the 5 years financials to prove the company can afford to do this. I have everything he asked for. And he goes, oh, did you do this? I'm like, yeah, I did it. He's like, oh, that's fraud, right? What do you mean? He's like, this is supposed to be by them. And snail mailed in. I'm like, yeah, but the office isn't open until the 10th. I got to get back. He's like, you're not going to the United States now for 99 years.
Wow.
I'm like, what are you talking about? I helped a company do over $3 million in 8 months. We hired 30 people. I'm like, I'm good for the economy, bro. What are you talking about? And it's, everyone's joking. I should just flown to Mexico and walked across. And I'm like, this is a joke. It's going to be old, whatever. And now I get the lawyer, the $6,000, the $10,000. Month goes by, 2 months go by. I'm like, what is going on here? I had to fly my dad down to San Diego to pack my life into my car.
Yeah. I had
2 months for my rent and then have him drive my car with all my stuff back into Canada. It took them 3 years to respond. 3 years for them to respond.
Wow.
And by then, I already have a new life and all this stuff. And when they replied, they said, you have 30 days to go to the airport, like the border, and get the fingerprints. Or I could go to, I was on a remote island in the Philippines. I had 30 days. It took 20 days for me to get the damn notice. And I'm like, it took 3 years to respond and I have 30 days?
Yeah.
Immigration people, I don't know what to say other than I don't, you know, don't accept my legal advice. But those people have a lot of power. That's all I can say. And even if you fight it and reverse it, which I eventually did, it can take 3 years for them to reply.
Wow, so, that's, yeah, it's definitely, it's a, when we think about immigration and process and policy, it does often come down to the person. But it's the person and what drives them and what do they get out of bed for? Do they want to get out of bed and be successful? What success looks like for them? A little story for me, being born in Singapore in Changi Hospital, the most haunted building in Singapore, back in 1975, the British government was handing it over to the Australian government. The New Zealand government was involved in some way. And then I arrived, screamed my first scream in the country and got a birth certificate. Dial forward 35 years later, I come to Singapore for an employment visa and I submit that birth certificate. And they come back and say, no, you need to provide something else. And I'm like, that's all I've got. And my mother goes, oh no, you've got another one. And I'm like, okay. So I go digging through her files and I find another birth certificate of mine. So I have a Singapore one, I sent it. I then had a New Zealand one, I sent it. 3 months later, still no reply. They came back and said, oh no, still not working, need some more information. And then my mother goes, which one did you send? I'm like, how many do I have, mum? And she goes, oh, there's a third one. And I'm like, a third one? So I'm 35 years old, finding out I've got a third birth certificate, this time registered in the UK. I grab that. It's a little like A1 sheet of paper, cut down small, folded up, photocopy it, notarize it, send it across. Within a day, done. Visa approved. I'm like, this is really random. I've got three different birth certificates stamped by government stamps, CHOPS and everything, but they couldn't find me. They couldn't find me in their system of who was Simon Burney, born in Singapore, raised in New Zealand, wanting to come back to Singapore.
Yeah.
And it all comes down to the individual person. And what I find is being authentic, being deliberate, trying to understand from their perspective, what drives them, what are their levers, what are their triggers? You know, I've come to understand that the more I do that, the easier it is to do business, to do customer service, to engage with people and get the right thing done for the right people.
Right. Yeah. A great book is How to Win Friends and Influence People. That should be a Bible for a lot of people that they read once a year, at least. I think there's a lot of value in that, that transcends cultural norms. Because almost like you said, the cultures are all very different. the social manners may be different, but things like using people's name, leading with reciprocity when you can. There's just some that are just very transferable, and everything is people. As much as we want to live by rule of law and all this sort of stuff, like you, I really appreciate that you mentioned, people don't necessarily notice it, but when you grow up in a country, you wear cultural lens. It's like a pair of sunglasses that you wear, and you've never seen any contrast. Without contrast, you don't know any different. And it's not until you start traveling, that's one of the benefits of travel, is you see contrast for what you know, and now you understand the world can be different, and it can be a real wake-up call for some people when they just impose, everyone's like us. I did that. I went to Japan. I lived in Tokyo for 3 years, and before I left, I remember people were like, oh, beware the culture shock. And I was like, culture shock, smalter shock. We're all humans. We all have hair and skin and hearts and moms and dads. One love. Culture shock is real, people. I don't know what to say. It's real. It's real. It's any tips for people trying to do business internationally or enter and emerge like a new market? I mean,
Daryl, just as you say, you said two things. One thing was a name. And Daryl, that is your name. No one can take it from you.
Right.
It is your name, Daryl. And forever, people will address you as Daryl. And in every culture, in every country, when you say their name, not the name they've given you as the English equivalent, but if you learn to speak their name in their language and address them like that, weight of gold. Because I was reading something recently where this person was having a rant about, why do people change their name to English names to do business? If you really want to do good business into an emerging market, learn how to say their name properly.
Yeah.
Be respectful. How may I address you?
Yeah.
Am I saying this correctly? How do I change that? And really be deliberate on that. And culture shock, for me, the biggest culture shock I've got is dealing with the United States.
Yeah.
You know, I had this wrong norm where I thought the cliche, pale white male, global market, America's international. But for me, going in there, East Coast is different to West Coast. Central is different again. But then you can't even go by geography. You've got to go by where is the person from, how long have they lived in the state, which states have they lived in. And I spent the last 4 years at Worldwide Technology learning more about the Americas as I was growing their international business into places like Djibouti, Qatar, Oman. Yeah. It's phenomenal. I'm teaching them about the rest of the world, and they're teaching me about the 52 states of America. It was amazing.
Yeah. It's diversity is stability. It's a beautiful thing. We need to respect that as much as, and that's part of the danger of centralization, is that if you even just think of experiments, Karl Popper was one of the most prolific science educators, and he had a formula for science. It was P1 plus TS plus EE equals P2. So you have problem one plus temporary solution, plus you eliminate the errors via observation, experimentation, discussion, debate, all this thing. It leads you to problem two, or you still have problem one, but now you know why your temporary solution is flawed. And a lot of that is just, we need, it's almost nature. Nature has no place for species that don't have a ton of kids. Nature, you have to have, the turtles have to have 300 kids so some can survive and live on. And that's why we need diversity. If we were just one civilization and it collapsed somewhere, there would be, throughout history, civilizations have collapsed, but there's always been fringe civilizations that have continued to exist despite of that. Diversity, we need, bless everyone's soul, we need diversity. We need difference of opinions. If you only have one temporary solution and it doesn't work, you're screwed. You need different people to approach it. Anyways, I'm getting on a bit of political soapbox.
But so when we think about diversity and diversity, equity, and inclusion, we, living in Asia, it's easier in a way to be faced with diversity because the way that people travel today, there's lots of different cultures around. But it's embracing it. And one thing I did as part of Dell Technologies was as part of the MARC program. So I was a facilitator for MARC, which is Many Advocating Real Change. And what I did through that facilitation of those courses with senior leaders inside Dell was bring out the awareness of gender diversity, but also ethnic, cultural, education diversity, marital status, parental working cities. So there was 26 questions you ask, and of those, only four of them are visual. Everything else is about, do you have a disabled child? Does your mother not work until you went to school? These things that are not on a piece of paper. And in going through those sessions, it brought out with a lot of people, especially to me, to my heart. I sat in the room the first time I went through it, and they asked a question, and you stand in a room, everybody in one line, and they ask a question, and you step forward if it's yes. You then turn around and you look at each other without saying a word, just take in what the difference in diversity that's not on the surface. And one of them was, step forward if you're not living in the country that you were born in. And so I stood still because I was born in Singapore. And so all of the expats walked across the floor. And of that, there was like 20 of them, and there was like six of us that were born in Singapore. And I was the one, or as they call it, pale white male. And they look at me and they go, hey, you are, go over there. They said, not born here. And I said, I was born here.
Yeah.
75. And they go, huh?
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. And this is my home country. And that was a turning moment for the class, because because Singapore tends to be a transit hub for a lot of people, in for 2 years, in for 5 years and out. A lot of the perception was, you mustn't be from here.
Yeah, and so I spent a lot of time. You don't land here kind of idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And from then on, those people actually spoke to me more, understood me more, in a way respected me more for what I was trying to achieve by enabling the pioneer generation to have better health, to enabling the people with disabilities to get access to more things, helping go through the Dell Design Forum around where buttons should be on monitor screens for disabled people. All of those things is really important. On Breast Cancer Awareness Month, I dressed up in as much pink as I could. And the organizer said, can you go over there? And I'm like, what's that for? And he goes, because you're working for us. And I'm like, no, I'm a guest. Like, I'm one of the entrants for this charity run. And they were like, really? And I'm like, yeah. And it was funny, because then I was asked to come to the Lions Befrienders, which is a charity organization, to be recognized for the money I'd raised for the senior citizens of Singapore. And it was on the same month as Breast Cancer Awareness. So I was wearing this bright pink jacket, like fluorescent pink business jacket that I'd worn to the office and worn down the streets of Singapore. And I sat in this hall where I was one of six that weren't Chinese, Malay, or Indian. And the night was going on, and the MC, who channel changes across eight languages like a TV remote, this guy's amazing. And he asks a question, and I put my hand up, and he comes down and goes, it takes a brave man to wear a pink jacket. And I said, Breast Cancer Awareness Month, just like giving back to the pioneer generation. It's about, I've got sister-in-laws, I've got mothers, I've got daughters, I've got a wife. It's, for me, it's all important about the unsaid story around breast cancer. And he goes to me, where are you from? And I'm from Singapore. And he goes, in channel changing mode, he clicks across three languages and goes, if you're from Singapore, I'm from Batam, which is Indonesia, an hour away by boat. And I said, here's my passport. I just happened to have it with me. I said, sure. And he goes, oh, okay. And then channel changing his apology in different languages. But it was that, the appreciating the diversity and then learning it and sharing it and being brave, being authentic. For me, the way that I look at it is, when I speak to different languages, I speak slower. I ask them to say to me, if you don't understand something, speak, tell me, because I don't understand. When I go to Japan, I'll enter a room with business partners, and then I'll say, hi, welcome. And I'll say, hey, team, I trust you guys to get it right. I'm going to leave the room now. You guys work it out. Call me back in when you need me. Because I don't want them to feel awkward speaking in English. I want them to speak in their local language, and if I understand it, but I trust them to do that. And I'll be on a WebEx, and I'll be talking to China. They'll be in local language. I'll have a colleague on the phone. I'll be listening. And then I'll ask them, what did they say? Okay, cool. And so I'll be on there. Because ultimately, for us to do global business, we need to find people locally that will embrace your brand, drive your message, and be your ambassador of your story. And you come in as the authentic person. Be deliberate. Try the local foods. Do the local things. Wear local clothes when appropriate to really connect with those people. And I found great success going to Vietnam, talking in front of a technology summit around professional services in Vietnam, having chats with customers afterwards where they're like, can you do more for us? And when I say to them is, I can help broker that with you. Here's my team. I edify my team. I give all the glory. As you edified me at the start of this call, this is this person. They're from this many years of experience. They know how to do this. And the customer then goes, wow, you've really got rock star people. Versus just saying, this is Tom, he's an engineer. Yeah. They didn't think this guy's a janitor or a mechanic. Whereas I'm like, no, this guy is a specialist in these technologies. He's got so many years. He's done this many deployments. And they're like, this guy actually knows it. And then when he talks, they listen to him, which is something different, which I've learned over the time, is if you don't edify people in a meeting when you introduce them, and if you allow them to edify themselves, people don't believe them. You've right. got to have somebody do that.
Yes. What you say about yourself is not as important or powerful as what other people say about you.
100%. Yeah. And in the medieval times, we had that person that came with us that would roll out the scroll and say, this is Simon Burney of family, Maureen and Dan Burney of lineage, Scottish castle, clan, MacLean, that sort of lineage. And then you'd stand there and they would respect you. And that's, and then you bring your authentic self to that level of skill.
Right. I love that. Can we pivot for a second? Because I want to talk about DE. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but when I hear you talking, it sounds to me like it's really about collaboration with a basis of merit versus inclusivity. I don't know if I'm articulating that well enough, but you know what I mean? It's where does merit go into that? I think is the question a lot of people are asking when it comes to DEI, and there's a lot of concern around quotas and things like that versus merit. And that, again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but that's what I heard you say. Could you speak to that a little bit? Am I right? Am I wrong? Am I off? Would you change?
Yeah, so diversity is having, there's a common saying, diversity is being invited to the dance, and then inclusion is actually being asked to dance, and equity is being able to dance as you want to dance in a way that you want to without being judged. And when we think about things, the diversity is being deliberate in your awareness, your non-conscious bias around bringing people together, and then ensuring you've got diverse thoughts, ensure you've got challenges, ensure you've got alternate perspectives. And then the equity is understanding that on video calls, some people don't want video. In meetings, people don't want to talk. They can't talk in English well enough to give you an answer, so they won't give you the right answer. So right. The equity piece is understanding how best to enable them to be able to communicate, collaborate, give ideas, give leadership in that structure and really going forward. And sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's hard when we're moving at 200 miles an hour, wanting to get stuff done, break into a market, grow funnel and penetration. It's hard when you then understand, okay, so how best do I work with you? Because when you look at their merits and their achievements and their ability, their potential is unlimited. Everybody's potential is unlimited when given the right coaching.
So I'm going to push back a little bit on this, only because I agree wholeheartedly. Like, every human is valuable in the eyes of God and in the eyes of their parents and as a citizen. There's a stat, U.S. military, they want to recruit anybody and everybody they can. But it's 1 out of 10 people aren't qualified to push them up on an IQ test and aptitude tests. So they have to reject roughly 1 out of 10 for a military service where they just need to point, pull a trigger and not shoot the people around them type thing. Mm.
Yeah.
And this comes into where the merit is. If your child needs a heart surgery, that's the delicate dance I think we have to do. I think, because I'm not.
If we just, on that point, that aptitude test, when I applied for the Navy in New Zealand, I failed entry into the Navy because I was too smart for the job that I wanted. And all I wanted to do was be a diver. Right. I wanted the Navy, New Zealand Navy, do 5 years with them, learn how to be a deep sea diver, and then go to oil rigs.
Right.
And when I applied for that, they said, yeah, nah, you don't qualify for that. You're on the wrong end of the scale. And I'm like, well, I don't want to be an officer. I don't want to be a pin pusher. I don't want to be that. Dial forward many years. I met a submarine pilot from the Scottish Navy. And he said, Simon, you can go this route to get in after being an officer. I'm like, had I known?
Yeah.
But then I think about another one where I did an aptitude test for a job interview for a large telco in New Zealand to do a cable rollout sales role. So my job was to go and convince customers to buy this new fiber optic network that we were building across the country. I did the aptitude test. They rang me up and said, you cheated. And I said, why? And they said, I need you to do it again. So I did it again. And they go, you cheated. And I'm like, how did I cheat? It's an aptitude test. And they go, because you are the perfect candidate. And I'm like, so what's the problem? And they go, no. And I'm like, so then your aptitude test failed.
Yeah.
Because you didn't hire me based on the aptitude test. And that's where, what are we testing for? The person that comes.
Yeah, I feel like it's the real
core. And so when I say the best, sorry, Daryl, when I say everybody has the potential to do anything, at the end of the day, we are limited by what our internal desires are and what our physical abilities are that we have available to us today. Everybody has a job to do. And I've got this guy who's an amazing cabling guy. Like, he can dress the back of a data center rack like the Michelangelo on the ceiling. Like, the cables are beautifully curved, Velcro's beautifully tied, color labels, everything, labels. It's perfect. He doesn't want to be a manager. He doesn't want to be a leader. He doesn't. That's what he does perfectly. And every day when I see him, I put my hand to my heart, I shake his hand to my heart, because that's his culture. And we have a very nice conversation. He goes, Simon, this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And he does an amazing job. And other people looking in at him are like, this guy's XYZ. And I'm like, no, this guy's amazing. Here is the pictures of his work that he's done.
You talked about Japan. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but I worked in Japan for 3 years. I was a consultant for Shinsei Bank and at their headquarters. And I remember I went there once and there was a lot of activity going on. There's a lot of people around. Oh, what's going on today? Oh, there's a conference. All the custodial staff are coming in from all the branch locations and they're going to be a speaker. I'm like, oh, that's interesting. The custodians are here for a conference. Who's speaking? And they said there is a gentleman. He's been a custodian for 70 years and he's there to talk to them. And in my mind, it was the whole concept of, in my head, I was like, oh, you clean toilets and push a broom. But after 70 years, you're like, we are a pillar to the fabric of this. You know what I mean? Like the
pride of workmanship. I've been to many places and I respect and thank any facilities person, any security guard for their job, because some of them, as you say, it's that, like, literally I was in a mall yesterday and this uncle was standing outside, and we call people older than us in Singapore uncles and aunties. Mm. It's a meaning of respect. And I smiled at the uncle and said, good morning. I went into the facilities. I used the facilities. I came out and said, thanks, uncle. Really nice. And he'd set up little tissues. Everything was wiped down. And he'll come in and make sure it's clean. And then he'll go out. And then as people go through, he cleans it. And I was like, this guy has pride for his job.
Yeah.
And that is really amazing. And that's where, as you say, regardless of what level you are in an organization, diversity and inclusion, diversity, equity, and inclusion is about looking after and caring for and enabling everybody.
Yeah.
To the best value.
I'm all for that. As long as there's performance metrics in there somehow. I think that's...
Agreed.
We also have the Peter Principle, which I actually saw a real world experience of this Q4 last year. I'm not going to name any names, but let's say someone's a really good sales rep. So then they get promoted to sales team lead and they do great as a sales team lead. So now they're sales manager and they do great with sales manager. So now they're regional sales manager. They do a great job. And now they're made CEO and they suck at that.
Yeah.
So stay there because you can't demote them out of a knot. And so I literally met someone and in my mind, I'm like, this person is a phenomenal sales rep. They're terrible as CEO. Terrible, terrible, nightmarish CEO. So I just think
that promotion track, Daryl, is definitely very, very delicate. When we go from practitioner to leader to executive leader, there's definitely pivot points where that person potentially could have become chief revenue officer. So give them more sales and something else, but don't let them run the organization, because it takes a different type of person to do that. And for me, in promotion and progression, when I advertise a role, I interview without camera. I don't care what they look like. I don't want to see a photo. I just want to see, want to hear their passion, hear their drive. I want them to tell me what they're going to achieve, how they're going to achieve. And the one question I do ask them, which is a curveball, why would I not hire you for the job? Which is the opposite to what everybody gets asked, right? So why should I hire you? And you say, oh, I've got this laundry list of all these good things. When I say, why should I not hire you? I'm looking for their non-conscious bias. I'm looking for their weak spot that they know they've got and what they're going to do about it.
Mm.
And so if somebody says to me nothing, I'm like, thanks, good call, see ya. Yeah. Whereas if they say, Simon, I don't have this skill, but I'm good at doing this and I will attempt to learn X, Y, Z. And I say, that's great. Because when you pick a team to play American football, you don't put the kicker in at quarterback.
Right.
You don't hire the kicker based on his quarterback skills. You hire the kicker based on their kicking skills.
Right.
Yes, you help them enhance their skill. You make them better. But in industry, in jobs, we hire for their talent, not for their gap.
Right.
And if they know their gap, and they say they're going to, not the word compensate, but they're going to, you know, be aware of it, that allows me to go, this person is aware of themselves and the value that they can bring to the business.
Yeah, I love that. Can you go through the tiers? Because I thought that was really good. You're like practitioner, leader. What were the tiers?
So it was from a practitioner to a leader to an executive. Because you can go from a staff member to a team leader to a manager. That's all just leadership positions, senior manager leadership positions. But when you go into that regional leadership and then that country leadership and then that region global leadership, there's a big pivot. And the further up you go, it's more about understanding how to turn on the people that are beneath you to be successful.
Right.
Whereas as you go up those levels, it's about how do you be successful with your team.
Yeah, I think that's really powerful. Some of the world's best coaches, like the Williams sisters, their dad was a nobody. He had no career in tennis. He didn't even know how to play. Some of the best coaches in some of these, they can't play worth anything, but they have the skill set required that they churn out champions. And I think that's why I love that you brought those tiers. I did Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu for 6 years, and I learned in doing a lot of like training camps and things like that. I trained with some people that were world champions. They were just horrible coaches. I feel like I'm talking bad about people, the sales rep, CEO, and the world champion is terrible, but I'm just saying, like, he was phenomenal. You just couldn't touch his, you just moved through people like a hot knife through butter. Terrible at articulating how and why he does what he does. Terrible at it. And so I just thought that was a really important tier to mention. And I want to mention one thing, something I found useful to help is coming up with three key metrics. I got this software company I was closely involved with years ago. And they basically, every role is defined in three key metrics that you can rank in a 1 to 10, describe very accurately. And this is part of the weekly one-on-one weekly performance. And depending on the size of the company, maybe it's down to the individual level, maybe it's just the department and the team is responsible, but you have three key metrics that define world-class for that role. And you measure the weekly score, the average, the highs, the lows, and that helps bring some objectivity to the role and to the performance. And then that's where I came forward with my thing about collaboration and merit, is that not excluding people, like you mentioned before, like treating you differently because you're not front. He's not born before. Well, actually he is. Oh, like trying to not have our bias, try to avoid fooling ourselves.
Yeah.
People's potential are.
Yeah. And we got to remember that we as humans sell to humans. And so if we're going to a different market, if you want to sell successfully in an Indonesian market, you need an Indonesian with you, and you become the cultural broker of the conversation.
Right.
And they teach you about the culture and you teach them about the business, and together between yourself and your local representative and the customer, you're enabling that brokerage of understanding the cultures. And then you go, as you say, the metrics, was it revenue? Is it cost? Is it a number of leads? Is it customer service? What is customer delight for you? Those things will naturally come out of these little levers below, where if I go to Cambodia, I don't know how to do business in Cambodia. I have yet to do business in Cambodia. I will do what I do with any other market, is I will find a person who is bilingual at least, so they can speak my, you know, English and Cambodian. They have experience internationally and domestically, preferably from Cambodia. Actually, I've got a prime example right now. I'm working with three customers in Mongolia. One of them is a large telco. They want us to help them put in a 5G solution to enable internet data to the villages in Mongolia. The city of Mongolia, the main capital city of Mongolia, has connectivity. They're asking us to do that. My job now was to find a cultural broker, a Mongolian that speaks English and Mongolian, knows telco, 5G, Wi-Fi 6, and is willing to work between US, Mongolia, and Singapore. That person for me, when I find that person, is going to be gold, because that will enable both the customer and myself to be the most efficient in how we talk to each other, how we communicate, what words we use, the speed, and getting that business done. And so for me, I've learned a cultural broker is so critical, and you respect them, you trust them, you enable them, and then the success will flow.
That is such a powerful, really powerful tip, because I think that part of what we need more is more international collaboration. And I think more small and medium-sized businesses need to think internationally as well. We have to expand in our local markets for sure. But I think we can't just leave, no offense, because I know you don't want to just leave it to the big corporate conglomerates and big government, that there's more that needs to happen. More of the grassroots need to be involved as well. And I think that what you've given so far are just some fantastic, phenomenal tips on this. I also want to be respectful of your time. I want to follow up. Is there anything I haven't asked you so far that I should have asked you?
No, Daryl, this has been a really great conversation. No unnecessary pregnant pauses. Back and forth has been healthy. One thing I'll share is my final where I started from. My father was in the army, so I can sometimes be militaristic. And that's because I'm driven for results. What I've learned as I've gone through the ranks in my army cadets that I did and in my corporate life is the more about compassion and understanding the people to drive them. But what I did when I was young, I had a group of kids when I was an officer. I was 21 at the time, and I had children between 12 and 18 with me that were going to a competition, skill at arms competition. And we went through it, and I made them visualize each event together. In a room, I said, close your eyes. You're all standing here. You're this person beside that person, beside that person. Okay, let's go. And so on this confidence course, I told them they were 2x2. This person was with this person, and I knew this person was faster, this person was slower. And I talked with their eyes closed, every single piece of equipment, who was going over what order. And when they did the race, they took off like rabbits out of the burrow. Yeah. And the assessors were like, these guys are going to fail. Like, they're going way too fast. And they nailed the course completely. And they came back afterwards and said, that went exactly as you said. And I said, no, it went as you wanted it to go, but you'd visualized your success. And so if you want to be successful in the market globally, visualize your success in valuing and enabling those that you're using in your team to be successful.
I love that. That is so powerful. If people want to continue the conversation, if they want to reach out, if they want to learn more, what is the best ways for them to get in touch?
Just go to my LinkedIn, Simon Burney. I'm on LinkedIn there. I'm happy to connect with anybody and talk. Yesterday, I was talking with a person around leadership and career development. For me, it's if I can help other people in the world to be successful, then the whole world benefits from it.
I love it.
Thank you so much.
If you need to connect, go to LinkedIn and look up S-I-M-O-N, Simon Burney, B-E-R-N-I-E. You know you got the right guy if he's from Singapore.
There's two others on LinkedIn, but mine's the photo with the corporate suit on.
There you go, right? Yeah. And having worked at Purview and, of course, went to SP Jane School of Global Management. Simon, this has been a great conversation. I have a couple pages of notes. Thank you so much for joining us, knowing you have your own direct reports, your own following, your own community. Thank you for coming and sharing with me and mine so we can all do a little bit better.
Thank you, Daryl. Really appreciate the time, and I look forward to working with you further.